Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we are listening to Sins of Our Fathers, a novel by Sean Lawrence Otto, published in 2014 by Milkweed Editions. The audiobook version is broadcast with permission from Blackstone Audio.
"You're working against me, aren't you?" said Eagle. J.W. saw it from his perspective for a moment, how everything, starting with the one big coincidence of J.W. moving in across the street, all fell into place. He had wanted to believe. He had needed to believe. "No," said J.W. It was a lie, but it was also true in the sense that he never would have burned down the bank. "Johnny,
get out before I do something I regret."
J.W. sat for a moment. He wanted to say something, but he couldn't think of anything that would not come out sounding like an unforgivable betrayal. He stepped out into the night and watched as Eagle pulled away and left him standing alone on the road. He walked across the dark gravel and through the dewy grass to his shadowed trailer home, soaking his shoes and socks. A form moved in the shadows. "John White," a voice said. Too late, J.W. saw the man as he stepped out and shoved a pale envelope into his hands.
"You've been served."
He turned and walked back into the shadows, and J.W. saw the outline of a dark car parked there. The glass of its door gleamed like a knife as the man got in. Then the lights came on and the engine started, and the car pulled out and drove away, leaving the sulfurous stench of a new engine's exhaust hanging thick and noxious in the air. Inside, he tossed the envelope onto the counter. He went into the bathroom and leaned over the sink. Things had taken a dangerous turn. This was not the kind of thing he'd ever imagined himself doing. And yet, he couldn't escape the feeling that he was responsible for the setting of the fire, at least in part. He took up his toothbrush and covered it with paste. He brushed his teeth and tongue for some time, but he couldn't get the awful taste of smoke out of his mouth. He spit and watched the water swirl down the drain. He sat on the edge of the thin mattress and ripped the envelope open. Inside was a note on bank stationery, scrawled in Jorgensen's handwriting. "Honor your commitment," it said, underlined twice. The note covered a formal notice of foreclosure. J.W. crumpled the notice in his fist. He turned off the light and sat there in his boxers and white t-shirt. He kicked the flimsy wall. His gaze rose to the family photo on the nightstand, barely visible, like the memory of a dream. For an instant, he felt like smashing it to the floor. Chris, Julie, Carol, and him, all in front of the house, all happy. He grunted and looked away. The sum total of everything he had done. A middling father in a dwindling town, teaching bankers how to rip off Indians. He reached into the clothes hamper and pulled out the bug receiver. He plugged it in, tuned it, and put the earbuds in. He felt a rush of self-loathing and almost pulled them back out, but in the end, he was in this battle to win. He had to win. He heard the faint sound of running water and the clack of dishes. The dinner plates, he realized. Then the water was shut off, and after a brief moment, there was a loud, smashing clatter, as if a whole stack of plates had been dropped into the sink. He heard the sound of breathing, followed by a startling, anguished cry. The sounds were closer now. Footsteps, the door closing, a faint click, and a dim light went on in the window to Eagle's office. Then J.W. heard the closet door opening. His heart leaped, and he rushed into the kitchen and rummaged through the junk drawer until he found the recorder. He punched rec, set one earbud next to the microphone, and put the other in his ear. He listened to the rapid clicks as Eagle spun the safe dial to the zero mark, then recorded the quick spins of the combination. His heart was racing. He felt as if he were lurking in the room and might somehow be caught. He had the combination. He heard the fine rustling of a plastic baggie. The pot. Eagle was getting stoned, he thought. it was getting even better. He heard the pipe being lit, and the sizzling of the pot in the bowl. He sighed, thinking again of the fire and its consequences. He balanced the earbud and went and poured himself a Dewar's. J.W. lifted the glass in a toast to the earbuds still lying on the mattress and to the man getting stoned beyond them, then downed the harsh fire water in a long gulp that rushed back up and pounded him between the ears. Eagle held the red calumet in his hand and stared at the rising band of smoke. The pipe had feathers carved into its bowl, and there were stones held to its 6-inch stem with leather bindings. He put a disc in the CD player on the bookshelf, Buffalo Soldier, and turned the volume down. He sat back in his Aeron chair, then slowly spun the pipe in his hand, watching the small gray stream of smoke spiral around and around in the holy way of his mother's ancestors. He looked up at the clock, and his eye fell on a book on his shelf called The Assassination of Hole in the Day by Anton Troyer, an Ojibwe historian and writer. Winona had given it to him, and one particular passage had always struck him powerfully. The book chronicled the age-old hostilities between the Dakota and Ojibwe people fought across the battleground of Minnesota as the Ojibwe migrated west, encroaching on Dakota territory in search of the land where food grew on water. It was a feud fueled by the guns and the economic interests of French traders who wanted the gold of the age, beaver pelts. And yet, despite the often brutal hostilities, each autumn the two great warring tribes of the North would call temporary truces in order to hunt and prepare for winter. The Ojibwe word for it was Bindigodadawin, which meant to enter one another's lodges. Even in the most heated periods of conflict, Bindigodadawin was a common practice, he remembered reading. Ojibwe and Dakota would enter one another's lodges, sleep in the same buildings, smoke the same pipes, form friendships, and even marry. Then they would be at war again the next spring, killing one another and taking the scalps home as trophies, or for bounties paid by the French, the Dutch, and the English. For Eagle, the Bindigodadawin was also over. Chapter 22. J.W. woke sweaty from a tangled passage of darkness. His mind lurched into the self-reproaching lucidity that had become an all-too-familiar midnight companion. He rose and paced the dark trailer, his mouth thick and dry, replaying his situation like a caged lion, a fruitless ambulation with no exit. He drank 2 glasses of water and took an aspirin against the hangover, a trick his father had taught him in junior high, and went back to bed. He dreamed of the wild horses. They milled around near the smoldering embers of Johnny's bank as the sun climbed past dawn, their many colors visible through the smoke. In the morning, J.W. looked outside. Eagle's Bronco was gone. Ernie and the other Indians were already at work, stocking and turning. The bank fire was distressing, but the wild rice business went on. Ricers were still coming in, and Johnny needed them now more than ever, he supposed. J.W. sat on the edge of the bed, stiff-jointed and aching, a dull throbbing in his temples, and hardened himself to what he had to do. The fire would not stop the bank. In fact, it was stupid and unnecessary and would only make his job worse. As sickened as he was by it, he had a larger mission, and that hadn't changed. If anything, it was more important now than ever. And for this reason, first and foremost, he had to maintain access. A hot shower cleansed any remaining doubts from his mind. He dressed for work and stepped out into a bracing morning, a high crystal ring to the air, the thin scent of the fire, and the smell of fall. He crossed the road and headed up the drive toward the wide-open barn as if nothing had happened. But when he neared the parching fire, Ernie stepped out of the smoke and blocked his path. The others continued working silently. "Good morning," said J.W.
"We don't need you today."
"Oh, come on, Ernie." J.W. went to step around him, but Ernie blocked his path again.
Johnny says you're no longer welcome here.
His face was as hard as granite. Okay, fair enough. J.W. nodded, worlds shifting. His only chance to maintain access would be through Jacob. As J.W. passed the paddock, he saw him in the lean-to. He walked over. Jacob ignored him.
I came to work, but Ernie says they don't need me today. You want to work on the horse?
I can't believe I trusted you. J.W. had expected this on some level. The kid deserved an explanation, but a disavowal would have to do.
Jacob, I had no idea that anybody was going to burn down the bank, I promise you, okay?
And it was true. Jorgensen had hinted at it, he could see in retrospect. But at the time, he couldn't have predicted it.
J.W. could see that Jacob wanted to believe him, but then the boy pulled away.
I'm going to sell the horse, he said.
Don't do that, J.W. said,
stepping forward, firm. He took another step closer into the lean-to.
Look, I've made some pretty bad mistakes, but two things I know for sure. One, I didn't burn down that bank. And two, you were at the beginning of something really special with Pride, and I'd hate to see you throw that away because you're mad at me. You set a goal, and you shouldn't give up on it.
Jacob looked at him.
J.W. stood frozen. There was nothing to say. Maybe you're right. He walked out of the lean-to and into the pale morning sunlight. He saw his blue trailer in the copse across the road and headed for it with a growing feeling of resignation.
Wait!
J.W. turned around. Jacob was standing in the lean-to opening. J.W. softened his face. They stood and looked at each other for a moment, and then Jacob said softly, Okay, let's train. Jacob walked back into the lean-to and picked up a saddle off the rack. J.W. stood there for a moment to let the feeling subside. Jacob cinched up the saddle, put the bit into the horse's mouth, and pulled the headstall up over his ears. He led the horse into the paddock and closed the gate. He climbed on and sat in the saddle, concentrating.
Okay, he said. I'm going to do everything you said.
Then he lifted the reins, and J.W. forgot about everything else. Before him was not a rider and horse, but a single living animal, smooth and reflexively intuitive. The boy just needed to be pointed in the right direction. J.W. threw himself into the task, forgetting temporarily the more unsavory aspects of what he intended to do. By mid-morning, he and Jacob were working Pride at a trot, practicing a more refined way of turning the horse without using the reins. Dust hung around J.W.'s ankles as the horse turned in the sand, over and over. Several more carloads of Indians arrived, and as they weighed in their fresh rice deposits, most of them observed the unlikely pair. Ernie and Supersize Me stretched a large blue plastic tarp out on the lawn near the paddock to accommodate the extra volume, and soon there were 600 or 700 pounds of rice spread out across it, drying green and purple in the sun. J.W. felt like heading to his trailer for a drink of water and a break from the sun and dust, but he saw Ernie watching him and decided not to. He ducked through the rail to the outside of the paddock. As he put his elbows up on the top rail, he heard loud rap music coming down the hill behind him. He turned and saw the car full of Indian boys.
Hey, man, one of them yelled from the front passenger seat. It's Tonto and the Lone Ranger.
J.W. started walking toward them.
Why don't you just leave him alone, he said.
The biggest one was driving. He looked to be 18 or 19.
He casually put a hand out the window, and J.W. saw a gun in it.
He stopped in his tracks.
Yeah, I thought so, old man, the driver said.
He aimed the gun at the tarp full of wild rice, and a shot rang out. Rice jumped, and Pride leaped sideways and into a run, frightened by the report. The boys laughed as the car sped off.
Yelled Jacob. His voice was scattershot with panic. He was trying to control the racing horse, but he was halfway down one side of the saddle, hanging onto the saddle horn to keep from falling to the ground.
"Hold it," replied J.W. "Turn him! Pull the left rein! Turn him around you!"
Jacob grabbed the left rein and pulled it with all his might to turn the horse tightly around his body.
"Don't stop," J.W. said. "Keep him going. Stick your heel into his side."
Jacob was tiring, but he kept turning Pride with the inside rein and goading him on with his outside foot and hand, still partway out of the saddle.
"That's right. Keep him going. Use his lungs against him. Urge him into it. If he runs, he has to learn he doesn't stop until you say stop."
The horse began to tire.
"Keep him going. Make those lungs burn."
After another few turns, J.W. could see that Jacob was starting to get sloppy and might fall off.
"Okay," he said.
Jacob let up on the reins and Pride came to a stop. The horse was drenched in sweat and his breath was steaming, even though the day was warm. Jacob pulled himself back up into the saddle. J.W. could see that his leg was shaking.
"You okay?"
Jacob nodded weakly.
"Yeah, I think so."
"You hung on. That was good."
"So what happened?"
Jacob swallowed and exhaled. He looked as if he was going to cry.
"He got scared. They were
"Forget them. You almost got dumped. That's on you." Jacob's eyes were wet. He turned away.
"He doesn't need you either,"
said Ernie, approaching the paddock.
"Ern," said Jacob.
"Language," said J.W. gently. Jacob yelled, shedding adrenaline. He looked back at Ernie.
"Just leave us alone, okay?"
He rubbed the tears from his eyes on the back of his sleeve. Ernie looked from Jacob to J.W., then shook his head and headed back toward the pole barn.
"Okay, I know you're upset. Let's talk it out. What happened?"
"He shied."
"Right, with you on him. What you always got to remember is that a horse is insecure. He's a herd animal, just like a stupid banker," J.W. said.
Jacob laughed through his tears. He was beginning to calm down.
"Herd's got to have a leader to keep him safe, right? If you're a herd of two and you don't lead, who will?"
"He will, I guess."
"That's right. But he's not as smart as you, and he's much bigger. He's not going to look out for you. So how do you lead?"
"I don't know. I was trying."
"You were hanging on. I'm talking before he shied. You got to lead. That means you got to anticipate what might happen and check him before he gets scared. Okay?"
"They shot a frickin' gun. How am I supposed to?"
"You just do, okay? Look, out here everybody shoots guns. You could be riding anywhere and somebody'd shoot a gun. You could be hunting on horseback."
Jacob was unconvinced.
"How do you anticipate anything?" asked J.W.
Jacob shrugged.
"I don't know."
"You know your horse, and you know which situations might cause a problem for him. You let him know that you're in charge, and if he does what you say, he'll be okay."
A breeze took up all the leaves of the nearby trees, setting them fluttering in yellows and reds. Jacob shook his head, not really understanding, but more receptive now.
"You saw them coming, right?"
"I guess."
"Okay. Now, he's going to shy at that tarp because of what just happened, right? Horses have long memories when it comes to danger and survival. So take him around and get him to face it. Teach him that it's not dangerous."
Jacob sighed, then took Pride back out to the rail and began circling the paddock. J.W. could see Jacob's leg shaking with fear as he worked Pride up toward the tarp. It was a safe bet Pride was also aware of the shaking, and it was probably eroding his confidence.
"Keep his mind occupied. Ask him to sidestep to the left and then to the right," he said.
He watched as Jacob got Pride to take the hesitant steps. He saw the horse's legs quivering, on the verge of leaping sideways or bucking and running away again.
"Okay, ask him to stop and then turn and turn back. We all need to keep our minds busy so we don't get overwhelmed by life. Same for him. Keep him busy with stuff to think about."
He watched Jacob turn the horse back, and this time he gave him a small reminder check with the reins and his left knee just before the tarp. Pride weaved in slightly, but Jacob's knee was there already, nudging him back out. And with that little bit of anticipation and resistance, Pride stayed the course.
Good job. He did it.
Jacob laughed and patted Pride on the neck, his face brightening, and he looked over to see JW give him a big thumbs up.
Really good. A tough situation and you handled it. Okay, take him around again.
Jacob turned the horse back toward the tarp at the far end of the paddock.
You know that boy loves you, don't you?
It was a woman's voice, reedy and husky. JW turned to see her walking up to the paddock fence rail next to him. She was in her mid to late 30s, he guessed, and she had a rough but beautiful appearance. She had high cheekbones and wore feathers tied into her shaggy dark hair. She was wearing an olive t-shirt and skinny jeans, cheap sandals and a toe ring, and she smelled strongly of alcohol and cigarettes.
"You're the neighbor," he said.
"Yeah."
A flicker of emotion flowed through her face and was gone.
"Is that a problem?"
"It depends."
She nodded.
"I've been watching you," she said, turning to observe Jacob. "He doesn't get like this with most people."
She pulled out an American Spirit and lit it with a cheap plastic lighter, then held the pack out to him.
"I don't smoke."
JW turned back to Jacob.
"Okay, bring him around again."
He turned back to her as she stuck the cigarettes back in her tiny jeans pocket.
"So, do you party every night or do you take weekends off?"
She blew smoke.
"Really? That's how your mother taught you to start a conversation? JW, when you grow up, first thing you do is give a woman s***."
"You know my name."
"Well, you're right, and I'm sorry." Then to Jacob.
"Again!"
And then back to the woman beside him.
"I guess you saw me raiding Johnny's house for booze then."
It was a calculated risk, but one he had to take.
"Is that what it was?"
She blew more smoke.
"You should have asked me."
She extended a hand to him.
"I'm Mona."
Her eyes managed to look at him and away at the same time, darting above a smile that was both coy and somehow volatile.
"I tried. You wouldn't answer the door," he said, ignoring her gesture.
She smirked and dropped her hand. She walked up to the rail and put her arms up on it. His eyes fell past the shelf of her breasts to the midriff exposed under her t-shirt. A tattoo climbed out of her jeans, a bird of some sort.
"If you were a single white woman who saw an ugly Indian going through your brother-in-law's house next door, would you answer your door?"
She glanced at him.
"Ugly?"
JW grimaced.
"If it was so scary, why didn't you call the police?"
He turned back to watch Jacob, who was circling the horse in a smaller loop at the other end of the ring.
"I thought maybe you were a friend," she said, blowing smoke at the horse. "Obviously, that was before I came to know who you are. And then I watched my nephew fall in love with you."
"Don't blow it with him. I don't want to see him let down. It wouldn't be pretty."
She looked at him, then began walking toward her house. She turned back with a wry expression.
"Oh, and, nice for an ugly white guy."
He sensed a kind of teasing amusement as she brushed the hair and feathers out of her face. It was strange, considering what she had just said, especially on the reservation, where most Indians looked at him with silent resentment. She smiled, sensing his confusion, and walked away more rapidly.
Chapter 23.
JW watched as Mona walked toward her house, but she didn't look back. It was as if a ghost had blown in and become suddenly animate, altering everything about the situation. He refocused on Jacob and the horse.
"That's right," he said. "No matter what distractions come up, you keep him on task. Again."
He wasn't used to women being as aggressive as Mona, either. He had been so wrapped up in his own collapse over the last year that the idea he might be attractive to a woman hadn't really occurred to him. As he stood there at the rail, he remembered the foreclosure notice in his back pocket. He pulled out the crumpled document,
then refolded it and put it in his shirt pocket. He leaned on the rail and watched Jacob. He had recorded the safe clicks. The mini recorder was in his jeans pocket. He looked toward the pole barn. The Indians were hard at work. In the paddock, Jacob was repeating the routine with pride. J.W. glanced back behind him. Mona was gone now. This could be his best chance. The house was just a few short steps away. Just take the pot out of the safe and put it in the desk drawer, he thought. It wasn't stealing. And it wasn't planting anything. It was making Eagle face himself, just like he had to face himself. And it was advancing the cause of justice. He watched Jacob make another round on the horse. If Johnny didn't wind up opening the bank, he'd still have his wild rice business. There would be no foul. It might be better, in fact. Eagle was too absorbed in the battle, forgetting in the process what was important about a boy and a horse, and about the wide river of time that flowed through our bodies with such force and speed that it took things away before we knew what was happening. If Eagle were to lose the bank, maybe he would focus on his son again. J.W. knew it was a rationalization, but it was also true. He would still have to find a way to deal with Jorgensen, of course. But first things first. If the big book was teaching him anything, it was the importance of taking life one day at a time. He looked up at Jacob, still on the horse. "You keep working," he called to him. "I gotta run inside and use the bathroom." Jacob waved to acknowledge him, and J.W. headed up toward the house. He didn't notice Ernie watching him from behind the smoke of the parching fire. J.W. stepped inside and closed the front door. "Hello? Johnny?" There was no answer. Eagle's Bronco was gone, but he needed to be sure. He had only a minute or two. In the study, he looked out the window. Jacob was still working Pride down in the paddock. The lawn was clear. "Hello?" It was like calling into a forest. The aspen leaves fluttered, watching. He took Eagle's fancy pen off the desk and headed for the closet. He opened the door and quickly lay down on the floor in front of the safe. He took out his little spiral notepad and set it on the carpet in front of the safe. He spun the dial to zero and pulled the digital mini recorder out of his jeans pocket. He switched it to quarter speed playback, thumbed the volume to max, and pressed play. He mimicked the number of clicks, 1, 2, 3, until he got to 9, then pressed stop and wrote a 9 on the notepad. He picked up the recorder and pressed play, turning the dial once again with each click, going all the way around and past 9, past 0, and then back to the number 91. He pressed stop and wrote 91, then pressed play one last time and turned the dial forward 22 clicks to 13. He turned the lever, and the safe opened.
You have been listening to Episode 14 of Sins of Our Fathers by Sean Lawrence Otto. The novel will be presented in a total of 23 episodes. If you miss any, you can catch up on our website, ktwh.org. Choose Programs and then Literally from the North Shore from the drop-down list. Please join us again next time for Episode 15 of Sins of Our Fathers, here on Literally from the North Shore.